nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, thank you for coming this morning. This is the last NSAC seminar of the semester, and we have Dr. Tim Fisher speaking. He did his previous work at Cornell and came to us from Vanderbilt University, where he was a professor, and he does a lot of carbon nanotube growth and applications.
Okay. Thank you very much. So today I'm going to talk about some aspects of thermionic and actually field emission, general electron emission from nanoscale carbon materials. It's an interesting topic. I tend to come at it from a heat transfer and energy conversion standpoint, and so I will emphasize those. I'll give you an outline here. I'll talk first about an introduction and the basic theory of electron emission, and then I'll talk about some thermionic energy distribution measurements that we've done. Also fit in some field emission electron heating measurements that we've done, and then talk a little bit about some nanoscale features that might or might not be useful, and then I'll wrap up with some conclusions. To start here, the first thing to understand is that there are really two predominant electron emission processes that can occur. Generally speaking, we're going to start with two electrodes separated by vacuum, and we'll call the electron emitter the cathode, and the collector will be the anode. And when I apply an electric field between these two, I can create an emission current in one of two ways. The first way is to allow electrons to hop over the barrier and then get into the vacuum and proceed on to the anode. That's called thermionic emission. And not surprisingly, to make that happen, we would need to have the cathode at a fairly high temperature so that there are some high-energy electrons that exist. The second way is to apply a sufficiently strong electric field so that the barrier that the electrons see at the right edge of the cathode is small enough for some non-negligible number of electrons to tunnel through that barrier. And that's called field emission. Here it's listed as tunneling electrons. So this these are the two main types of electron emission that I'm going to talk about today. This tunneling process is an exponential process. So we need to get a very thin barrier, but once we do, that barrier width delta, once that becomes small enough, then we can get a fairly large current flow. I'll start giving a little bit of history first about thermionics. It all started when people started to heat up metals, and then they started to see some charge phenomena happening. And so that happened first in the late 1800s. Thomas Edison saw it and saw electrons going to a positively charged collector when he heated a metal to high temperatures. And then later in the early 20th century, the process was quantified, the theory was developed for this. Richardson was one of the pioneers here. He won a Nobel Prize, in fact, for this, and eventually came up with an equation that we still use quite extensively today. Some of the applications, before I go deeper into the theory, include cathode ray tubes, microwave sources, vacuum gauges, scanning electron sources. And so there actually these types of electron sources are ubiquitous in a lot of the things that we do today, even in a wide number of applications in research. My interests are more toward the energy conversion part. The bottom cartoon shows a concept in which one would apply heat that could derive from a variety of sources that are listed here, and heat a emitter to a sufficiently high temperature so that the electrons will come out thermionically. They can be collected in a cooler portion of the system, and that process can potentially produce power generation. So that's a thermal to electrical energy conversion process. The thermionic current was quantified and observed first by Edison, and there was a lot of controversy at the time, or at least uncertainty about the nature of this process. Some people thought it was actually chemical reactions that were happening to drive this. In 1912, Richardson derived an expression for current density that evolved over the next decade or so to include some quantum considerations. But in the end, what we do to calculate the thermionic current density is basically to calculate an integral over a weighted function that includes the velocity of the electrons as they approach the emitting surface, the probability distribution, which took different forms as quantum mechanics developed alongside this, but eventually that's going to be the Fermi-Dirac distribution, then integrated over k-space. When you do those integrals, they're actually pretty easy to solve. You find that you get an expression for current density that depends on the square of temperature multiplied by an exponential term that includes an energy barrier, that's phi, and the thermal energy, kBT. So if we look at this expression, it's pretty clear that if I want to have a significant amount of current, that I'm going to need to have a fairly high temperature to achieve that. I'll show you later some of the resulting energy distributions of the electrons that come out of this process, but I want to first show you that as we increase the temperature of an emitter, and this is this is representative of a free electron emitter, what we need to do is we need to increase the electron energies up to the work function of the material. So phi is going to be an important parameter, and it's essentially the difference between the Fermi level and the vacuum level. And once we have that, then the electrons come out and we can actually measure their energy distributions. In practice, one of these, a thermionic device, particularly one that would generate energy, might look like the electron motive diagram might look like what's shown here, where in essence, on the left side, we have a hot cathode heated to temperatures of 1,000 K or higher, and on the right side, we have a cold anode. And what we want to do is not only to motivate the electrons to emit out of the material, but also to proceed to the anode. And that anode, in order to generate power, needs to be at a higher electrochemical potential than the cathode. And that's shown here. You'll see that mu2 is higher than mu1. In other applications where you're not looking to generate power, you can actually decrease the electrochemical potential on the anode side, that's mu2, just to collect the electrons if you're just looking for an electron source. But if you want to generate power, you have to allow the electrons or force the electrons to run uphill in energy space somehow. And so what happens here is that there's a number of different important things happening. We see first the work function, that's lowercase phi 1. That's a very critical factor in determining how many electrons actually get out. The capital phi 1 that's shown next to lowercase phi 1 is the effective barrier that the electrons see. And it's a combination of a couple of things. First, the electrochemical potential on the other side needs to be higher on the anode side in order to generate power. So the barrier is actually going to be a little bit bigger than just the surface barrier or work function of the emitting material. And then also, once I have filled this vacuum gap with electrons, there'll be a space charge effect that can adversely influence the emission process. And that's shown qualitatively as that sort of curved top to the energy barrier. If we make the gap small enough, the vacuum gap between cathode and anode small enough, then we can mitigate the effects of space charge pretty easily. So I want you to have this picture in mind that this is how a thermionic power generation device would work. After we know how much current comes out of the cathode side, we can use that those same principles to calculate what comes out of the anode side. But now, to calculate the net current, the net thermionic current, I'm going to use the capital Phis. These are the effective energy barriers to thermionic emission. And we'll include both emission current from the cathode to the anode and the possibility of reverse current happening from the anode, from the anode to the cathode. And we can keep that reverse current, which is the second term shown here, fairly small because we can cool the anode. And so T2 would be a very small, would be much lower than T1. As I said before, I'm also interested in energy exchange processes, and this is important in understanding how the energy conversion process happens itself. So what we do here is we simply weight the emission current by the energy of the electrons as they go over the barrier. The emitting electrons are replaced, and this is an important point. The emitting electrons, no matter where they originate, are replaced by other electrons to conserve charge, and those replacement electrons actually come in at or very near the chemical potential. And so what we do to calculate the heat flux, and this is this is something that should be fairly intuitive, is we just multiply the thermionic current times the energy of those electrons, and that product of current and energy is going to give us a heat flux. Energy would be in electron volts, and there's a charge normalization that you have to do. So we can look at both the heat flow from the cathode to the anode, that's 1 to 2, and the reverse heat flow to get the net, to find the net energy exchange in this process. Once we've calculated both the thermionic current, the net thermionic current, and the net energy exchange, we can start talking about how efficient these devices might be. So first of all, energy conversion capacity is going to be the product of two things. One is the voltage that you generate, and the second thing is the net current flow between these things. So there's just current times voltage, as we all learn in physics and early in our academic careers. That's an easy calculation. The thermal efficiency is going to be that power generated per unit area, that's P double prime, divided by the heat loss in the system, and that's going to be Q sub H in absence of other things. This is really more of an ideal efficiency because there can be other modes of heat loss from thermal conduction, thermal radiation. So this is the actual heat loss, the electronic heat loss, and again, it's calculated below. So this eta is the thermodynamic efficiency. What we want, ideally, as engineers, is we want a high power conversion capacity, that's P double prime, and we also want a high efficiency. And trying to get the two of these things together has been the big challenge in using these devices as energy in energy conversion processes. So there have been a number of limitations. First of all, most materials have high work functions that are 3 electron volts and higher. There's some things that have a bit lower work functions, but that kind of work function is too high in general to achieve efficient energy conversion. What we want to have is a much lower work function that allows a higher current flow. There are also some surface phenomena that are challenging in an engineering sense. I told you before that we want to have a small gap between these electrodes so that we minimize the effects of space charge. Well, once we do that, and we're talking here about a few microns or less, of the size of the vacuum gap. When we do that, we subject ourselves to the possibility of shorting, especially under thermal expansion, and that can be a problem. And there are also some issues with a lack of surface planarity, chemical contamination. Keeping a good vacuum is important, and if you start to get oxidation into your system, then especially at high temperatures, then you're going to have problems with that. There's also some instability at elevated temperatures, so some instability of the surface chemistry. What I'm going to show you later is that one of the things we try to do is to really control the surface chemistry of these emitter materials, and at high temperatures, controlling that chemistry is difficult. Here's an example result for a thermionic diode, three-dimensional materials. And what I'm plotting here is the power generation capacity on the left axis, the thermal efficiency on the right axis, both of those as a function of the generated voltage. So the generated voltage is something that you can engineer in this process. That's the difference between the electrochemical potentials of the cathode and the anode. We want that to be fairly high, right? We start from zero in this graph, but we would like the generated voltage to be high because we will have other losses, lead losses in the system, especially with high temperature materials being involved in high temperature conduction. So, ignoring all of those other losses for the moment and just looking at the power generation capacity based on the difference in the electrochemical potentials between the emitter and the collector and the resulting efficiency, we get something that looks like this. Looking at power generation capacity first, we see that we can get to reasonable power generation levels. That's close to 2 or almost 2 watts per square centimeter, which is a respectable amount of energy. It's not a huge energy density, but it's not bad. You could imagine that if I wanted to create, say, a 1 kilowatt device, a 1 kilowatt power generation device, I would need roughly, at least if I were operating at peak here or close to the peak, I would need about 1,000 square centimeters to do that. However, one of the problems here is that the electronic efficiency, the electronic thermal efficiency, or the ideal thermal efficiency, really doesn't increase very much until we get to higher generated voltages, and indeed to generated voltages that lie in the regime where our power generation capacity has dropped off. Why is that? Well, our power generation capacity has dropped off in this case at this particular temperature and work function. And I should have mentioned this before, the work function here is 1.68, which is very low. It's representative of a cesiated metal. But the problem here is that once my generated voltage increases too much, then that effective barrier that the electron see is so high that the current flow is very low. Okay, so trying to engineer a system, we have competing interests. One is to have high power generation capacity, and the other is high efficiency, and they don't seem to match up very well here. Before I go into some of the experiments on thermionic emission, I want to talk a little bit about field emission. So field emission, as I said before, is a tunneling phenomenon where I'm trying to reduce the barrier, the potential barrier at the surface of the emitter. And when I do that, if I make it a few nanometers generally in width, then I start to see a significant amount of current flowing through. I won't go through all of the details of field emission theory, but basically one solves the Schrodinger equation, and there are different approximations that you can make along the way to find the to calculate the field emission current and also the field emission electron energy distribution. One of the things that I guess today is fairly obvious to try to do to enhance field emission is to make sharp tips so that they look kind of like antennas. And in this way, we can concentrate the electric field around the emitter and increase the the current density by quite a bit. So a couple of things that I'll talk about here, there's a factor beta that becomes important. So if I want to relate the local electric field to the applied electric field, that's kind of the macroscopic electric field, the difference between the potential on the cathode and the anode divided by their distance, then typically what's done in the community is just to multiply that average field by a field enhancement factor called beta, okay? And this factor beta can take a magnitude up to around 1,000 for a very sharp tip. But in essence, what happens near this tip is that the macroscopic field that would be linear if I had two planar electrodes becomes curved so that the barrier width decreases near the emitter site. And that's the idea that's the reason that we want to make sharp tips. The basic field emission theory, that has been developed and was pioneered by Fowler and Nordheim back in the 1920s. We do a little modification of it. We instead of just taking that overall applied field, the original theory applied to planar electrodes, we multiply the applied field by this factor beta, and we can come up with an expression for current density. And you'll notice that in this case, phi, that work function, becomes an important factor in determining how much current we get out. So we still want to have a very small work function in order to get high levels of current out of a field emission device. It ignores this development, by the way, ignores thermal considerations entirely. It assumes that you're basically emitting at zero Kelvin, so that my Fermi-Dirac distribution is really just a step function, and therefore it's not useful for some of the thermodynamic modeling that we do. This is a graph that shows that talks a little bit more about the linearization. Again, we have this work function. We have some field emission. The actual potential profile near the surface is going to look like this curved solid line. And the Fowler-Nordheim theory with the field enhancement factor included really just takes that curve and makes it a straight line. And in fact, you should note that what happens in this process is that we stop satisfying the anode side boundary condition, which is also problematic if you want to look at things like energy conversion. There are ways to improve this modeling, as shown here, where we can be a little bit more rigorous about the way that we introduce that potential profile into the Schrodinger equation. I won't go through all of the details of this, but you can see in this graph that what we have is, for a tip radius that's R, capital R, of 5 nanometers, we see that the curve actually looks pretty similar near the emission site, but then it tails off over here. R of infinity is essentially the flat plate type solution. All of these curves would produce the same amount of field emitted current, okay? And so you can see that R equals infinity is actually has a very high field. So in other words, we would need to apply huge voltages to get this current out. Whereas if I had a tip radius of 5 nanometers, I have the same type of potential profile near the emitter site, but the actual potential drop is much smaller. What we've done with field emission mainly, and I'm a mechanical engineer, so, and most of my interest involves energy and heat flow, is we've looked at the electron beams that come out of field emitters and the consequences, the thermal consequences on the anode side. So we've looked at these electron beams coming from, in this case, a single-walled nanotube, and looked at the heating profile on the anode, because these beams can be very energetic, and they can cause damage, thermal damage, wherever they impinge. And this is an example of an image that we've shown or that we've calculated. What we did to make these measurements is we put a single wall, or rather a multi-walled, a single multi-walled carbon nanotube on the end of a tungsten, of a sharpened tungsten tip, and then field emitted from that. And again, this is the temperature profile that we see. A couple of points, just looking at this profile, it's not quite symmetric, so we had to look at a few different data lines. But you can see that the concentration of heat is very localized in the middle, and then it spreads out. These are infrared images that we took on the backside of the anode. And in this case, we had an applied voltage of about 450 volts and a current of 37 microamps. That's a pretty respectable amount of heat load in a fairly small region. This the field of view from that infrared image is a couple of inches wide. And in this case, so we have a high concentration of heat. And if we went a little bit higher than this in terms of current, we would cause damage to the electrode at the center. I'm going to move on to thermionic, back to thermionics, to thermionic measurements. And what we do with those is we take different materials, we heat them, and we allow them to emit electrons. Those electrons proceed up into a hemispherical energy analyzer that I'll talk about in a moment. But we do this with the purpose of first characterizing the work function of materials. And that's been done for a long time, but a lot of the new nanomaterials have not been characterized in that way. And really what we're after is the search for finding a material, a nanomaterial, that might have a very low work function. That's our first objective. And secondarily, we want to look at the electron energy distributions to see if there are any changes in the electron energy states or the density of states that may be favorable for energy conversion. The energy analyzer operates as follows. We heat a sample, that's down here at the bottom, to the point where we start to see a measurable signal, electron signal. The electrons are then set into an electron focusing column. We might apply a small bias to get them into that focusing column or to coax them into going there at a higher rate. And then this focusing column will do a couple of things to the electron beam so that it's focused on this entrance slit to the energy analyzer. Then once the electrons are in the hemisphere, we adjust the voltages or the potentials on two concentric hemispherical shells. And by adjusting that voltage, we can control the energy of the electrons that are able to proceed all the way through the hemisphere and reach a detector on the right side. So basically, we sweep through different voltages on these shells and over an energy range of interest. Once the electrons actually get to the exit slit, there's an electron multiplier that allows us to sense or to detect an electron that comes through. There are a lot of different parameters that we can adjust in this system depending on kind of the quality of the electron source. When we have a very low electron current or thermionic current, then we'll open the slits. That allows us to detect, but then in those cases, the signal-to-noise ratio is very high. And so we have to play around with that. Every material has sort of a different character, particularly different work functions. One of the important factors in this is the resolution of the instrument. These slits will cause some spreading of the true electron distribution, and so we have to adjust for that in our calculations of work function and the electron energy distribution. And in fact, I'll add here, Ron Reifenberger, back in the 70s and 80s, was one of the people who pioneered these kinds of measurements. He's in physics here, and we work with him today. One of the important things that we've done is to calibrate with a known sample. So we took single crystal tungsten, which has a known work function of 4.5 or around there. And this is the character of a thermionic electron energy distribution. We start out, we see at low energies, we see no emission because we're below the work function of the material. Then once we reach the work function of the material, once we're a little bit above that in the energy space, then we start to see a sharp increase in electron current for a given energy. That peaks out at the top point here, and then there's an energy tail. This is really the tail of the Fermi-Dirac distribution. And you can see that when we fit this to a work function of 4.56, the fit is very good, and that's also consistent with previous reports in the literature. So the starting point is we take a known sample and we compare it to previous measurements, and we ensure that our system is operating properly. From there, we've looked at a number of different materials, and I'll kind of go through them fairly rapidly with just kind of looking at some of the possible interesting features of different nanomaterials in this using this method to characterize. First of all, we catalyzed a multi-walled carbon nanotube array on silicon. We used nickel as the catalyst, so you're going to see, I'll have to talk about some of the different work functions of the other materials that are present. This is a multi-walled nanotube array. The nanotubes had diameters of about 50 nanometers, so they're not all that small. if we look at some previous work, and I guess the first thing I should say is that the best macroscopic comparison would be to graphite, and the work function of graphite is known to be about 4.5 electron volts, which is pretty high. In fact, it's much higher than I think would be useful for use in a thermionic energy conversion device. Gronig and co-workers measured a work function for multi-walled tubes of 4.85, and one thing I should emphasize here is that carbon nanotubes are not some kind of homogeneous materials, and they can all be very different, even within the category of multi-walled nanotubes. So the fact that we're close, our work function that we measured was about 4.4 electron volts, which is generally consistent, although not precisely the same as previous measurements. Nickel, by the way, which was our catalyst and was still present to some extent in this sample, has a work function also of about the same thing that we measured, 4.5 electron volts. So this result is not that interesting, except to the extent that it's generally consistent with our expectations. For a single-walled array, this is an array of single-walled nanotubes. We see a new feature, and that's a leading-edge peak in the electron energy distribution. And I think we think we know what that is. I'll just say that there are peaks at about 4 electron volts and 4.6 electron volts in this distribution. Again, they're very high, probably not useful for energy conversion studies. And there was another group, again, Gronig and co-workers measured 3.7, which is actually lower than our expectations and somewhat lower than more recent work. But this leading-edge peak deserves some explanation, and we believe that this is a result of actually the catalytic template that was used here. That was magnesia, and the work function of magnesia, the reported range is actually quite wide, from 3.1 to 4.4 electron volts, and I believe that leading edge is actually from that background catalytic template. Okay, moving on to a different kind of carbon nanomaterial. These are graphitic carbon nanofibers. They're like nanotubes in the sense that, at least from the external profile, they're actually similar to multi-walled nanotubes in the sense that their diameters are about 50 nanometers. but they're not tubes, they're fibers, and so that means that they don't have hollow cores. And these graphite nanofibers can actually look kind of like a stack of coffee cups, if you will. The central core is likely some kind of amorphous, combination of amorphous carbon and with some graphitic content to it. Looking at this just for the graphitic fibers alone, this is the sort of a sequence of graphs at different temperatures. And we see that in these cases, the work function is about 4.7 electron volts. So again, consistent with what we expect from graphite, consistent with the multi-walled nanotubes. However, what we did to this sample was subsequently we intercalated potassium into the graphite structure. So that what that means is that we took a potassium source with our collaborators at Vanderbilt, that's Chuck Lukart in chemistry there, and the potassium actually fills the intergraphene plane sites to some extent. In our case, for every 8 carbon atoms, we had 1 potassium atom. This is a known method of reducing the work function of graphite, so we thought it might work here. And indeed, when we did this, we found that the work function reduced from somewhere in the 4.5 range down to something around 2 electron volts, which starts to look pretty interesting from an energy conversion application. We would like it to be 1, right? So we're not all the way there yet. But then there's another feature here that's interesting. The distribution narrows very significantly in these. These are the intensity of these profiles are normalized to 1. So we can look at them at kind of their full width half max as a measure of the spread of energy in the beam. And we see that for the intercalated samples, that spread of energy is much smaller. There's also some evidence of a secondary peak that's about a couple of tenths of electron volts beyond the initial peak. And that's interesting, too, because it starts to look like maybe there's a quantum confined character to this or a peak in the density of states that could be interesting. What's probably happening here is that we are localizing the electron states around the interactions between potassium and carbon atoms. There are some hybridized states that can occur, and those will have lower work functions. Now the question is, how do we engineer this so that we can produce this effect repeatedly and over large areas? And that's kind of something that where we're still working. The last set of graphs that I'm going to show from on the experimental side are for hydrogen-terminated diamond samples. So hydrogen is another one of those additives, kind of like the potassium, where that can reduce work function. And this is something that some other groups are working on as well. This is nanocrystalline diamond that was made at Michigan State in Greg Swain's group, and Ron Reifenberger also collaborated with us here on this study. And what I'm showing here is a collection of electron energy distribution. So let's start first with a distribution at 750 degrees C. We see the same or similar general character to the energy distribution at this first measurement at 750 degrees C. And we, importantly, we see a fairly low work function. Again, it's not as low as we'd like it to be, but it's much lower than what people normally see in diamond. Then we go up to a much higher temperature, nearly 1100 degrees C. That's the red curve. And what we find is that that the work function increases, or the apparent work function increases very significantly. And that is an indicator that we have lost something along the surface. Whatever was producing that low work function, we've lost at least some of it. When we go back down to 750 degrees C, we start to recover some of it. Now, I don't think what's happening here is that we're somehow recovering this hydrogen termination on the surface, but instead, if you think about how this would work, the diamond, the portions of the diamond surface that are not coated with hydrogen, have high work function, 4.5 or so electron volts. The portions that have hydrogen termination have low work function. And in all likelihood, what's happening here, and what happened originally, is that at lower temperatures, that high work function region really was not producing, the temperature was not high enough for emission to occur from those high work function sites. And when I went to a higher temperature, then they did. Now the question is, when we came back to the lower temperature, if that hypothesis held true and we didn't lose any of the surface coverage of the hydrogen, then I would just recover this original blue curve. But in fact, you could see it's different. And so our interpretation of this is that we lost some of the hydrogen in this high temperature excursion. This conjecture is, or interpretation, is generally confirmed by what we found in a residual gas analysis that happened alongside of these measurements, where we see the mass charge ratio, different mass charge ratios of interest. If you look at the inset here, we could see that at the high temperature, we saw a significant increase in the hydrogen content. That would be mass charge ratio of 2. And that is at least a qualitative indicator that we did lose some hydrogen from the surface, because the hydrogen is not going to be coming into the system from other sources. We also did some work on a different surface termination, which is very similar to hydrogen termination. This is nitrophenol, and saw, in essence, the same kind of thing. Again, at 750, we saw relatively low work function, somewhere around 3.7. And then when we went to a high temperature excursion, we saw an increase in the apparent work function. We went back down to the low temperature and saw a change in the profile. Again, indicating that we probably lost our surface termination to a large extent. This is perhaps the most telling graph that I'll show. This is a different sample, but again, diamond with hydrogen termination. What we did was we started at 700 degrees C, went up to 850 degrees C, and then regenerated the hydrogen and did a measurement at 750. So there's a sequence here that's maybe not so obvious. But in essence, what happens, or what happened in this case, is we regenerated the hydrogen before we went down to 750 degrees C. We basically just put the sample back into a hydrogen plasma, and again, we recovered that low work function character. I'm going to shift gears here at the very end of the talk to talk a little bit about maybe one way of using nanoscale geometries to enhance thermionic emission. Okay, this is not field emission. I talked before about enhancing field emission, but this is thermionic emission. So there's a Schottky effect that one can use. This is not a Schottky diode kind of thing, but this is the Schottky effect, where basically it's known that you can reduce the effective or apparent work function by making something sharp in the presence of an electric field. Okay. And this has to do with the treatment of the surface, the surface energy, in order to accommodate the electric field. So the Schottky effect in the presence of an electric field, and this is really an image charge phenomenon, will reduce the apparent work function of a material. And so what we want to do is make that tip very sharp and see if we can reduce the work function, and that's delta phi shown up there. And you can see that old factor beta shows up in that change in the work function, or the apparent work function, once again. So the idea here is, well, what if I took maybe even a high work function emitter, like diamond, and I made a bunch of tips, and we can make diamond tips pretty easily. Could I trick the system into somehow thinking that I had a low work function by using the Schottky effect and basically having a really big beta to reduce the apparent work function? And the answer is, you can. But it's going to happen locally. And so then the question becomes, well, can I create that effect over a significant surface area? So if we take an example here, let's say that we had a surface that had a work function of 3 eV, just sort of pulled out of the air, but not too different than the hydrogen terminated samples that I showed you before. I have a tip height of 1 micron, that's H, that's the height of those pyramids, for example. I have a local field enhancement factor that I can vary, and I apply some macroscopic field. Now, this macroscopic field can't be too high, because if it were, then I would be dissipating energy, right, rather than generating. I'm neglecting space charge, and I have a nice high temperature of 2,000 Kelvin, and I'll neglect any potential interactions among the tips. So if I take this example and apply it, by changing the tip radius and the pitch, I have three different pitches that I'm showing here. We see that until the pitch, we're now looking at a pitch of 25 nanometers, a pitch of 100 nanometers, and a pitch of 1,000 nanometers, and we're plotting the average current density as a function of this tip radius. So this average current density is the substrate level current density that I would see. We see that if my pitch is 1,000 nanometers, there's basically no effect. This effect is negligible. If my pitch is 100 nanometers, I might have an incremental effect or improvement in the emission current density at the substrate level, but it's only, you know, a 10% type of effect. If somehow I can get this pitch, and remember the height of these is always going to be a micron, if I can get this pitch to 25 nanometers, then I start to see a significant improvement when my tip radius gets out to 6 or 8 or 10. So basically the bottom line to this effect is that if I have these tips that are spread out on the substrate widely with a wide pitch between them, then I really am not going to get much of a benefit from this Schottky lowering, at least at the substrate level, which is what we usually want. And I would instead need a pitch, a tip-to-tip pitch of about 25 nanometers in order to make this work. Well, that really rules out cones or pyramid-type structures, because they have this base that will set the pitch to be very large. And instead, what we would want out of this would be a dense array of tubes or fibers that are spaced 25 nanometers apart or so. That's not so easy to do. And once I do that, then one of my assumptions that I listed earlier really probably does become invalid, and that is that the tips don't interact with each other electrostatically. So let me wrap up here with a few conclusions. These electron emission processes are interesting. I think they have some promise in energy conversion, but it's going to take, I think, a lot more engineering. Looking at this potassium intercalation, for example, engineering that so that we can get the work function to be even lower. That narrow energy distribution that I told you about with the potassium intercalated nanofibers is actually beneficial from an energy conversion standpoint, because basically if I wanted to convert energy, I want my energy range to be as small as possible. Any extra energy that I have, any kind of the wider the distribution of electron energies, the poorer your energy conversion process is going to be, because we're going to collect the energy at a given potential, and anything extra is just going to be thermalized. So that's promising. This electron energy spectroscopy, I think, is a nice tool to have. We have it here at Berk, and we invite you to if you have samples that you'd like to study with this tool, we're more than happy to help with that. The nanotubes seem to be similar to graphite in terms of their work function, unless you do something else to them. Potassium intercalation, I already talked about. These diamond work functions seem to be reduced up to about 750 degrees C. There's some lower temperature results that I didn't show, but they were stable at lower temperatures. But once you get above that, then your surface termination seems to desorb and then you get back to the original diamond material. And then lastly, I talked about this Schottky effect. So just to acknowledge, this is the last slide. Vance Robinson was a student who graduated a year ago, did some very nice work. Tyler Westover is a current student who works in this process. My collaborators, Greg Swain, Ron Reifenberger, Chuck Lukart, have all been very instrumental in this work. And then lastly, my sponsors, NSF and the Cooling Technology Center here at Purdue. So with that, I'll take any questions. Yeah?
When you're explaining the devices, you have cathode and you have anode.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have to choose these 500 to slide 8?
Okay. Okay.
So, do we choose the material which has lower power function and how does it work?
Right. Ideally, you'll have in a system like this, there are different opinions about this, but generally speaking, you have a cold anode. And to reduce space charge, what some people will do is they'll have a low work function anode and a slightly higher work function cathode, in some cases, so that you can actually have a field that goes like this while you're still that goes from high potential in vacuum to low potential in vacuum, and still generate power, meaning the chemical potential of the anode is higher than that of the cathode. But I think it's fair to say that generally you want to have low work function cathode and anode. Yeah. Yes.
Temperatures.
Yes.
Do you envision these devices as like capturing waste heat in some kind of plant and converting it as a sidecar generation, or somehow having standalone devices to generate so much energy that heat still isn't a factor?
Yeah, these are all good points, and of course it depends on the application. Waste heat would require very low work functions. So because you're talking about, you know, probably 600 degrees C, I think is what most people talk about as kind of the typical waste heat application. And I know that there are many variables in that. But for example, in solar, with concentrated solar power, you can get to much higher temperatures than that. Nuclear, obviously, you can get to much higher temperatures than that. And that's where most thermionic work was focused on radioisotope power for space, or has been in the past. Combustion processes also can come up to this level. And then this last thing, refrigeration, I didn't talk about, but that's kind of the opposite of this effect. So waste heat, I think, would require a very significant breakthrough in reduction of work function to make this viable.
Given this place where you explained hydrogen-terminated diamond,
right, I'm getting there. Okay.
Yeah. So, actually, I didn't understand quite a bit. What do you do to get this particular color? Do you heat the sample or substrate and then capture how many electrons are?
Yes. Yeah, so we take whatever sample we have. It could be hydrogen terminated, it could be a nanomaterial, nanotube, nanofiber, but that becomes the sample that's heated down at the bottom here. Yeah.
So what my question is, can you do this for any kind of substrate? Say you have a molecular-coated substrate of silicon wafer.
Mm-hmm. As long as it fits into the system, which is, you know, basically a 5 square centimeter sample stage, then yes, we can accommodate it.
Depend on how those hydrogen are coupled with the, I mean, covalently bond with the substrate, because as I remember, you heat it till 1000 Kelvin.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So as you did in case of hydrogen terminated diamond,
mm-hmm.
how strong those hydrogen atoms are bonded to the diamond?
That's a good question. So our results are consistent with what surface chemists suggest is the bond strength, and so they would predict that the hydrogen would desorb somewhere between 800 and 1,000 degrees C, and that's what we see also, right? So it's not a very strong bond, but I would say this, that this diamond sample and this hydrogen termination happens in a growth process that occurs around 900 degrees C. So it's it's still very much a high temperature synthesis process itself. So if the synthesis temperature were much higher than that, let's say if the hydrogen termination itself occurred at much higher temperatures, then we would expect that we would be able to go to higher temperatures because hydrogen termination the bond would have to be stronger to make that happen.
Yeah. I have one last question.
Yeah.
As you have your graph here, mm-hmm. and you heated the sample to 1085 C, and then the another graph at 750 C.
Right.
So why do you have these 3 peaks? Actually, you have got a 3 peak.
We do, yeah. That's a good insight. What's happening there, I believe, and I can't I can't definitively prove it, is that we actually have three kinds of surfaces in this system at this point. I believe that the three are, well, let me just say something about the substrate itself. This diamond sample actually is a collection of sp3 bonded carbon in crystallites that are 100 nanometers or so in size. You can see that from this image. In between those diamond crystals are graphitic-like grain boundaries, right? And then on top of that, I put some hydrogen, which in this case I believe does not completely cover the surface. So I believe that there are three different kinds of surfaces. One would be an sp3 type of diamond without carbon termination. The other would be a sp3 with hydrogen termination, and the third would be a graphitic type of grain boundary. And that's what I think these three things are corresponding to. And I think originally, probably the graphitic part of it was not coated or rather was coated with hydrogen termination as well. But I think that's the first thing you end up losing. But it's just speculation at this point. Yeah.
I had a question. So you're using a vacuum as your dielectric between the two electrodes.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't you just use a different dielectric?
That's a very good question. There are many people who are looking at solid state thermionics, and in that case, if your electron mean free path through that dielectric is longer than the thickness, then you can have essentially the same kind of effect that we see here. The question of why we don't do that, I mean, some people do it and believe that it will become a viable energy conversion material. And I think that there is some hope of that. However, once I put a solid material between something that is hot and something that is cold, all of a sudden, I have thermal conduction losses that I don't have in vacuum. In vacuum, I do have radiative losses, radiative heat transfer losses, but I don't have that conductive loss. And as you probably know from your own intuition, that once I put a solid material, even if it's a thermal insulator, right, that creation of a conduction path can destroy the efficiency of your device. Yeah.
This particular surface, hydrogen-terminated diamond, what is the contamination? Like, how fast does it contaminate?
Does it contaminate? So, do you mean
how stable it is? Like, suppose you got hydrogen termination.
Yeah.
And you insert it in. Do you prepare your sample outside somewhere? Or in the vacuum?
We prepare the sample in a plasma chemical vapor deposition system. And that, so if we go a little bit further here, in this case, we took a hydrogen terminated, a previously hydrogen terminated sample that had gone to high temperature and lost its termination, and we put hydrogen termination on it in. And so the question is it done in vacuum? Well, it's done at about 10 to 30 torr of hydrogen, right? And we strike a plasma, we create a hydrogen plasma, and that is what produces the surface termination. From there, when I take it out, when I allow it to cool and place it out in atmospheric air at low temperature, it seems to be stable for weeks or months, or you know, as long as we had held samples. We didn't do anything special to the samples to keep them from being contaminated. It's stable. Yeah.
So I think it's like on, I can't remember if it's slide 34, slide 36, that plot. Is that a simulation or is that actually experimental?
That's a simulation. Yeah, it's just taking basically the. All right, so taking this surface, and in these regions that I define here, having the Schottky lowering effect in place, and in regions out here not having it, and then applying basically the Richardson's equation that I showed earlier to those two different regions and then adding them up. Yep.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.